Welcome to the program for Friday, January 10th, 2014, 4:08 on In Depth with Francis Rose. And, of course, every Friday, it's the Federal News Countdown. Bringing it back now, we were actually on hiatus for the holidays for a couple of weeks, and I have just terrific guests, experts choosing the most important federal news stories of the week to kick off the 2014 Federal News Countdown season. John Palguda of the Partnership of Public Services, it's good to see you, my friend. Thank you for coming in.
Always a pleasure to be here, Francis.
And Mark Foreman, the co-founder of Government Transaction Services and former eGov administrator. It's great to see you, as always, my friend.
Likewise.
This is the beginning of the fourth year of the Federal News Countdown. We kicked this off in January of 2011, and it is just terrific that people enjoy doing it and enjoy listening to it. And you guys have both been on the program a number of times, and I thank you both for being here. We are going to start where we always do with the third most important federal news story of the week. John, your choice for that is from GovExec. The headline is 2014 brings more changes to federal pay and benefits. This is, if you look at this from a historic perspective before we look forward, I think this is a kind of a good news, bad news story, because 2013 could have been a lot worse for federal employees than it actually turned out to be, I think.
Well, absolutely. But the hope, of course, is, you know, 2014 is going to be better than it could have been. And of course, as an old federal HR guy, as you know, this, I had to do something that, you know, talks about, you know, workforce issues and pay and benefits. And this particular story starts, because there's several different things here, but it starts with the 1% pay raise.
Mm-hmm.
And a little sad when you think about it that, you know, it's like 1% is really good news. Yeah. A 1% increase.
Everybody's psyched.
But the fact is, you know, we're following 3 years of no pay increase. And even though, yeah, 1% doesn't, you know, start to make up for, you know, some lost buying power, it's symbolically very important. It's a psychological boost. Like, yeah, at least we've broken through the, you know, we can keep it down. Now, there's a couple of other pieces in this story which actually were kind of interesting. One, you know, depending on where you are, might be good or not, but the government will now – they're going to make it easier to recoup money from employees, federal employees who owe money. You know, mm-hmm. They get an overpayment, for example, and there had been a – 10-year statute of limitations, which has been eliminated now. If you're a federal employee, you owe money to the government, they can ask you for that back.
Yes.
As long as you still
until live. You pay it back.
Yeah, but then there's two other parts of this story which are actually, I think, pretty good things. And this is kind of down in the weeds for HR people. This, but there's a provision where if you work in the federal government. And federal employees mostly know this. If you get career status after 3 years of substantially continuous federal service, the benefit of having career status is that you can be reinstated indefinitely at any time. You've kind of proven your value.
Mm-hmm.
You can be reinstated. But if you have a break in service, you start all over again. And we have people in the military spouses who follow their spouse. They work for government. They have to quit. Then they find a new job a couple months later in the new location. And was like, well, but they're, you know, put it all together, they're still proving their worth. So this will kind of take care of that. As long as you have 3 years, even if there's some breaks, it still counts, and you'll get lifetime reinstatement capability. And the final part of it was this new pathways program for hiring.
Mm-hmm.
There's an internship component, and you can convert interns at the end to permanent employment. But interns typically, we're not eligible for some of the benefits, Federal Employees Health Benefits Program and dental vision insurance. They now will be. So that's good news.
That's good stuff. And the Pathways Program in particular is overall turning out to be very good for managers. I mean, it's brought some talent in to the government that probably wouldn't have otherwise come into the federal government, according to your colleague Tim McManus.
Yeah, the internships in particular. Now, there's three components to Pathways. I know this is not a discussion of that, but there's a Presidential Management Fellows Program. There's a recent graduates provision. PMF's working fine. Recent grads, there's a lot of issues around that. But the internships is a bright spot. because it's a great way to bring in talent, and they prove their worth. You have the ability as managers to cherry pick,
mm-hmm.
and if you've done your right job, most of them are people you want to keep, and you have that capability.
And they make sure that they understand what you're doing and that they buy into the mission of the agency.
That's
and
right.
the mission of your office, and that it's a good fit for everybody.
Yeah, and they're learning that, yeah, this is the place I want to be, and you're learning that, yeah, these are people I want to keep or not.
John Palguda's third most important federal news story of the week's from GovExec 2014 brings more changes to federal pay and benefits. Mark, your third most important federal news story of the week is my colleague Jason Miller's analysis, what the decline in bid protests really means. It looks like good news on the surface. It's not necessarily bad news when you dig into the numbers. What did you think, not just of Jason's story, but of the overall decline in bid protests, Mark?
Yeah, I think the title makes it seem like it's better than it is. We got a 10% decline in procurement dollars and 2% decline in bids. That's hardly a decline in bid protests. No, what I found most interesting about this article was the analysis that Jason included in this. So there are four chronic problems in government procurement. And this really, to me, adds the meat to the bone of what people have been saying about procurement being broken. So the first one that I'm fascinated by is that agencies fail to follow their solicitation evaluation criteria. So you go out for bid, the bids come in, the agencies say, oh, my God, I can't use that to evaluate the bids. And they award it to somebody other than the contractor that had the best, wrote the best to the specifications in that bid. Well, why do they do that? And having been on all sides of the coin, this gets back to that underlying requirements definition issue the government has. So that's still a problem. Second was the inadequate documentation by the agency on how it reached its conclusion. Okay, so that I kind of look at it as a more bureaucratic scheme. That's kind of the drive the truck through Fed bid Fed wire issues that we used to have in the 90s. Still a chronic problem. I understand that. Third one, unequal treatment of offerors. You know, so I'm fascinated that that's a chronic problem because, yeah, to some extent you're going to have the certain bidders come out, but that goes back, I think, to this underlying issue that you should have very clear specifications and in what you put out. Your requirements should turn into the criteria by which you choose your bidder, and you should have a fair way to grade them, and clearly that's not the case. Now, let me add the fourth one, a reasonable price or cost evaluation. So what's happening here is we're trying to get away from lowest price technically acceptable because we've dumbed it down so much that the government basically is buying everything as if it were a commodity, and we're losing the intellectual capital that we need even out of the contractor force to make the government work. And here we have these chronic problems of the source solicitation process that are driving us more and more down this path of don't differentiate, don't innovate, make it so simple, make it so open and transparent so that everything is the same cookie cutter and all we can compete on is price and have a same way of calculating the price. We've got to figure a way out of this chronic problem that's leading us down the path of not being able to buy what the government needs at a fair price. And these four problems, these chronic problems are what need to get addressed, but they're symptoms. They are not the issue.
It is interesting to me that if you went out and said at a some kind of an organization or gathering of contractors, are there more protests this year than last year? I think overwhelmingly people would respond, oh, yeah, there's a ton more than there are now. The numbers don't bear that out. Why do you think that is, Mark?
Well, okay, as a percentage, there are more. So it looks like there are more.
Mm.
Okay. The other thing about this is we're not really seeing the numbers because agencies are pulling back on the awards or the decisions. That's one of the things that Jason highlights because the agencies are basically saying, okay, you got me, when their general counsels come in to look at it. And so there's an underlying protest issue that's not caught in these numbers where agencies themselves, once they're caught, pull back the awards.
Mark Forman's third most important federal news story of the week is Jason Miller's analysis on federalnewsradio.com, what the decline in bid protests really means. You can find it and all of our countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. The Federal News Countdown continues with the second most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Mark Forman and John Palguda, next on In-Depth with Francis Rose. We're back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by John Palguda of the Partnership for Public Service and Mark Forman of Government Transaction Services. And we're up to
number two.
Mark Forman, your second most important federal news story of the week is, did Jason slide you a fiver or something before you came in here to pick your stories? It's another Jason Miller story at number two.
No.
I know. It's a joke, but it's Jason's story headlined, Hettinger strives to restore confidence, reinvigorate Tech America, your choice for the second most important story of the week. And Mike Hettinger's taking over as Tech America's new senior vice president of the public sector. And kind of a mixed reaction to Mike's selection at Tech America, it sounds like.
Yeah, the article was, I think it laid out some key points, but I think for the IT community, especially the government part of the IT community, this is terrific. I think a lot of Trey and Kara Hunton working with state and local government, both terrific. Very, very hard to replace their caliber of people. And for Tech America to recruit Mike, who has been very innovative in financial management reform, IT, and his recent work on innovation and the use of IT in government, and he knows the Hill. He worked on the Hill. He lobbied the Hill. He knows technology. He's a strategic guy, and he's also politically strategic or politically savvy, having been inside. Look, we're, to carry on the theme of procurement reform, getting into, I believe, a major year of IT reform and change in the way government does things with IT. You've also got a need for cybersecurity, which I think the target thing continues to push forward. So Tech America needs a thought leader who is politically savvy, and I know he may not be as well known among the IT industry as he is around the government IT industry. But I think this is very, very important for our community to have somebody at Tech America, which is a very important organization for our community, like
now,
Mike.
Now, John, I know you're not an IT guy, but you're a people guy. And Mark just touched on two of the most important areas that you and your colleagues that are people are thinking about in government. That's acquisition people.
Right.
Who are, there is a tremendous lack of in the government right now. And cyber and information technology personnel, a huge lack of people there. Those are themes, in addition to what Mark talked about, that I think your group of people, your thought leaders, are going to be trying to work on in this coming year. Is that fair to say, do you think?
Oh, yeah, well, absolutely. In fact, I was over at the Pentagon earlier today, on the Army side, talking to some of the HR folks, and they, you know, we were talking about skills gaps and stuff, and they brought up, you know, cybersecurity and so on. Fact of the matter is, you know, people think, well, you know, we've got still, you know, all these unemployed people looking for jobs, which we do, and government's downsizing, but they were saying, you know, an Army, they had a, you know, they've hired 30,000 people just in the last several months, but that's replacement hiring, and, mm-hmm. and they're still, it's not full replacement, but when they're hiring, they're looking for the, you know, the hard to fill skill sets, and, you know, and IT, cybersecurity are clearly among those, and they're having a hard time. I mean, you know, it's going to make a huge difference in terms of government's ability to even work with the private sector companies. You got to have folks who know what they're talking about. When you're dealing with the people providing services to government.
And that makes me think, Mark, that this is a time like no other time that I'm familiar with in government, at least, where all of these areas can't operate in silos anymore. People who think about information technology, have to also think about personnel and the pay and benefits issues and all of those things that go along with it. And the people, all of these areas that used to kind of be their own little areas are now connected to each other in ways that seems to me, at least, they haven't been connected before. Am I not seeing something the way things have operated in the past, or are you seeing this evolution also?
I'm actually seeing a disconnect.
Really?
I'm not seeing the evolution yet.
Okay.
No, I think we've gone through a period that's been, I'd say, probably destructive to the federal IT community, where we look at IT as a cost of operations rather than as a way to improve the effectiveness and efficiency of government. And so we've chopped off IT. Even now we're looking at hiring IT people as a way to fix the IT problem. As you say, this is connected. The IT problem is not an IT problem. It's a government effectiveness and efficiency problem. It just so happens the government is heavily dependent on information. It's a decision-making and services organization. So we need people who understand how to leverage technology into the effective processes of the government. It's not like we go out and hire a bunch of Java programmers. You know, it wasn't like that 10 years ago when I was at OMB,
mm-hmm.
and it cannot be like that today. You got to understand the relationship, and you got to understand how technology works in relation to all the different parts that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I think Mike gets that, and I think Tech America has a very, very important role in explaining that to members of Congress and for lobbying. How do you use technology in government?
Mark Forman's second most important federal news story of the week is Hettinger arrives to restore confidence, reinvigorate Tech America. Jason Miller's story at federalnewsradio.com. John Palguti, your second most important federal news story of the week is also from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is Lawmakers Put Finishing Touches on Spending Bill. Now, we're learning this afternoon on federalnewsradio.com that they couldn't quite get those touches in time for this week.
Yeah.
We're going to look at on Monday, I think a two-day continuing resolution
right.
to get us over to January 17th. And by the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, Congressman Hal Rogers, is saying this afternoon that he will introduce on the House floor the omnibus spending bill Monday. That should get us to a Senate vote by Wednesday, and everything should be fine. At any rate, the story, the broader discussion in this story is right on target, and that is, I think, really big news, which is, for long term at least, no continuing resolution. This is going to be an appropriated line-by-line budget that will look theoretically a little bit different, at least, than the budgets that we've seen going up till now. That's a big thing, isn't
it? It's a very big thing, which is why it's one of my stories of the week, because and it's like our first story about 1% seems really good compared to what we had.
Uh-huh.
Compared to what we've had, this sounds really good. Here we are. We're only about a third of the way into the fiscal year, and we may actually have a budget where managers can plan. I mean, I think what's been one of the worst parts about not just sequestration and the cuts, but the kick the can down the road business has been that, you know, government managers in the executive branch simply cannot plan well. You can't do workforce planning. You can't figure out your acquisitions, approach. There's just so much you cannot do well, and you're constantly doing scenario plannings. And we went through the furloughs and all that kind of stuff. So the fact that they're close to having an agreement. And I think it will happen.
Yes.
There's this 17-year cicada situation with the shutdown.
Yep.
We had it 70 years ago, 95, 96. We learned lessons that people want the government to work.
Mm-hmm.
And they forgot the lessons. They've learned it again. So we're not going to have another shutdown. I'm boldly predicting. and we're actually going to have, it looks like, a budget that's actually going to be $25 billion above 2013, $45 billion above what it would have been if we did not have agreement and we were the second part of sequestration kicked in.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still going to be a very tight budget year, but it's going to be more predictable. You can plan. You can do things that we ask government managers to do, but we don't give them the tools to do it. This is a big deal.
Yeah. Mark, a lot of managers that I've talked to in the past year or 18 months say, boy, I would take a smaller budget if I just had some certainty about it. I guess we're going to find out whether they really meant it or not, it looks like, don't you think?
Yeah. I still think that this is all inside the bureaucracy. Let's just go along to get along. And still, we're in the scenario where we cannot make the choices between programs that perform and ones that don't perform. And so we take these salami slicer approaches, salami slicer down, maybe glue a little few salami pieces here and there, but nobody has figured out how to allocate resources in line with results. And I have to say, there was no article on this, but a major grant rewrite regulation came out the day after Christmas. I haven't seen anything on this really in the press. It was supposed to be rewritten around what can you do with your grant money and so forth. And as of last summer, it looked like it was going to be delayed until March or late February and more with a two-week shutdown. It's been rewritten to target on results. So I don't know when Congress is going to really get with the GPRA Modernization Act they passed. But this really has to be about allocating money for performance. If we want managers to manage better, they got to understand to get the money they need to do better, to reward their staff or reward their constituency, they got to show results. It can't be, phew, Congress decided not to choose results.
We talked about this, though, before we went on the air, and the issue here is, I think, John, you mentioned it when we were out in the green room, and that is the idea that there's no incentive right now for somebody who is advocating for a program for their district where that program might already exist to say, okay, I'm going to encourage more of that. That doesn't help that person politically, and so that's why that's what doesn't happen.
That's right.
That's what has to change, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's I'm actually starting to see more of that in the executive branch. I'm not seeing it on the Hill yet. But in the executive branch, we are very definitely seeing signs where agencies are more willing to work together and say, hey, we need, you know, our HR IT system is antiquated. It's a legacy system, and it's costing us a ton to try to maintain it, and we can't afford to buy a new one. So how about, you know, we've got a sister agency over here that's got a good system. Why don't we work together? We can, you know, borrow their system. And so we're seeing a lot of more interest out of necessity for agencies willing to collaborate together, willing to look at, you know, developing common standards, even though they each love their own little, you know, the way they've been operating. And they're actually learning to cooperate and collaborate. We need that to come from the Hill.
Mm-hmm.
What you're saying is budget cuts work. And now if we start to pull back on the budget cuts, we're not going to see these efficiencies.
No, you could go there, but it's a matter of degree. So yeah, there, you know, budget cuts had some silver linings. Silver linings was forcing people to set priorities, to rethink, but you can take anything to an extreme. So it's all things in moderation. So, and your salami cut analogy was very good in that, you know, you end up saying from a oversight congressional appropriation perspective, everybody can take a 10% cut. You can always, you know, get another notch in the belt. The problem is we've got some government operations that are already on life support, and another 10% is just going to make them totally dysfunctional, where you have other places in government where that's, you know, they could take a 20% and probably still do fine. You gotta approach it. Well, you know this, Mark. You gotta look at it from a perspective of what makes sense here, and not do this cookie cutter stuff that you were talking about.
Sounds like you're headed both in the same direction, which is there are some places in government that, as you say, John, have room for a lot more restrictions than other places in government. But as you alluded to, Mark, we don't necessarily have a good handle on which is which. There are cases where we do, but there are some cases where we don't have any idea which ones are doing or performing better than others.
That's right. And I'm really excited about this new focus on performance and results out of OMB. You know, I think Shelley Metzenbaum laid great groundwork for that, and it's good to see that being taken up. Once people have the data, I hope it's going to be made transparency. I know the data.gov guys haven't caught on with this part of the program yet, but once we see the transparency about around results and cost, then I think there's potentially a lot more that can be brought into the debate in the Congress so that we don't get these salami slicer cuts.
John Palguta's second most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. Lawmakers put finishing touches on spending bill. It and all of our countdown stories are available at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. The most important federal news stories of the week is selected by John Palguta and Mark Foreman. Next, to finish up this week's federal news countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose. Be right back. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by John Palguta of the Partnership for Public Service and Mark Foreman of Government Transaction Services. And we're up to
number one.
And Mark Foreman, your most important federal news story of the week's from the Washington Post, and it's a headline, Behind the Scenes, White House Preoccupied by NSA Surveillance Controversy. It's a story by David Nakamura. What's here that, in your view, made this more important than the budget deal that we're about to strike or some of the other things that are going on this week?
This means this marks basically the fourth month, that's a third of the year, where the White House and the inner circle, the people, have had to focus on IT issues. They've had to come up to speed. You know, this is tremendous, I think, for the outlook for those of us involved in federal IT and understanding the management issues, that the White House started out as the guy with the BlackBerry who didn't really understand anything about IT in the government, has had to get so in-depth now, as has his staff, that they are gaining the understanding of the technology and the information policies issues that you really need to govern that $80 to $100 billion a year of federal IT spending. And you start to see that the IT is not the operations. It's not like we got a bunch of geeks. They're in a data center. Some of them are contractors. I don't know what they do, but by golly, we're going to have the best technology. This is about the operations of the government. And for 4 months now, these guys in the White House have been rolled up shirt sleeves trying to understand that and figure it out. I think we're going to get dividends for the rest of the administration because now they understand the issues.
This kind of goes back to a point that we made in the last segment. Mark and I disagree a little bit about this convergence that I see that he doesn't see. But this, I think, is where I get some of the idea, John, that personnel-wise, we're seeing a convergence and overlap among all of these various silos because, as Mark says, the president and his team are learning how IT works in the federal government, something they had not had to do before. When you look at this concept, not just the NSA, as this story talks about, but the healthcare.gov stuff and all those kinds of things, in the world that you live in, what's significant to you in these stories?
Two things. One is that I think a lot of the problems really go back to management issues and in the context of, there were some real management lapses, shall we say. And it's not just, oh, somebody screwed up. It's that I think, and we've seen this in other occasions when government has fallen down, we don't have enough of the right people in the right jobs. So the management capability of government, I think, has eroded over the last several years, partly because of all this external stuff going on, the budget issues and all that. We've lost a lot of great people from government, people like Mark, who's no longer in government. And I think you pay a price for that. So some of this is, you know, we're now recognizing, you know, we need to build up our management leadership capability.
You said that exactly the right way, though, I think. You said we don't have enough of the right people in the right jobs. And on the surface, somebody might hear that and say, oh, this is a people problem. But this is a structural problem, it
sounds
like.
That's the second part of it, absolutely. Because, you know, we've had all of our silos, or some like to call it the cylinders of excellence. You know, and we're finding that, you know, that's not an effective way to operate, and it's not an efficient way to operate. So it goes back to our previous conversation. The budget issues have been a forcing mechanism, I think, to cause people to think about how do we work better across organizations and take advantage of the fact that the whole is greater than sum of its parts. So if we can get, you know, people to work together, we're better off than if we just, you know, have them keep going down their individual paths.
You've lived in a couple cylinders of excellence in your life, haven't you, Mark?
Sure. Well, we are in an interconnected world, and government has to operate in this interconnected world. You know, it occurs to me several years ago when I was analyzing the big policy crises and why couldn't government handle them. You go back into the late 90s, and virtually every major public policy crisis we've had was a multidimensional crisis. The original, you know, 25 cabinet departments and agency structures, all hierarchical, no longer fits the public policy issues that we face today. Well, you know, the newest dimension to this is the tremendous disruption that technology's had in terms of communications and accelerating timelines. And it's not like I think many people thought, well, we'll just bring in a cadre of 50 folks and they'll figure it out for us. You know, my God, there literally are a million people working in government IT, mostly contractors, but a million people. And so it's not like we can just deal with these issues with a few new geeks. And by the same token, you have to understand the things and the people that you touch, the business processes and what the people are trying to do in their jobs, and how what you're doing with an information analysis or communications project or even information security affects the business of the people you're working with. It's a very complex environment now, and understanding that environment is, I think, more important than understanding why Google works, or what JSON means for open data versus XML. You need a few people to understand that. But guess what? As the folks in the White House are learning, this is about foreign policy. How does information technology relate to foreign policy? It's not a data center in Fort Meade.
Mm-hmm.
There are public policy issues involved in how we use IT. And I can't imagine a better learning ground for something as important as that White House compound and what they've had with healthcare.gov and these types of things over the last 4 months.
Is that why you expect this to have a payoff long run, because they're learning in right in the middle of the crucible?
Right, and these issues aren't going away.
Mm-hmm. Mark Forman's choice for the most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Post. The headline is Behind the Scenes, White House Preoccupied by NSA Surveillance Controversy. And you can read it and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. John Palguda's choice for the most important federal news story of the week wraps up this week's Federal News Countdown next on In Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, the Federal News Countdown this week with the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by John Palguda and Mark Forman. And John, there's a secret here that I think you know, but nobody else really knows. When Mark got here today for the countdown, it was the second time today that we had already spoken. We were on the phone a little bit earlier today, talking about the Government Transformation Summit hosted by the Government Transformation Initiative. And I'm very happy, Mark, that you're going to be on one of my panels next week. The Government Transformation Initiative is the organization that former GAO Comptroller General David Walker is running now. And they're doing an event called Innovation in the Future of the Federal Government Thursday, January 23rd, from 8:30 to 11 at the National Press Club. And you very graciously agreed to come and speak on one of the panels there. And I'm looking forward to that very much.
It should be quite exciting to think about innovation in the framework of getting rid of redundancy and so forth that they tend to focus on.
General Walker will speak about that. Tom Davis, a former chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, will be speaking at this event. There's two panels that I'm going to moderate. You're going to be on one of them. But among these two panels, we're going to hear from Dan Chenick, of course, your former colleague from OMB, and now at the IBM Center for the Business of Government, Horace Blackman from the VA, Dan Blair, who was at OPM, John, you know him very well from OPM, and he's now the CEO of the National Academy of Public Administration. We're going to put a link to that later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, because I don't mean to slight any of the other folks that are going to be on these panels, but there's just too many people, great people to mention, and we wouldn't have time to talk about your most important federal news story of the week, John, which is the whole point of the show in the first place. The headline from the Washington Post is, for federal employees, 2014 won't be as bad as 2013, but morale problems linger. And Joe Davidson takes this story in a direction that's a little bit different than what we talked about in your number three story, and it is that morale piece.
It is, and there is still an element here of, you know, if you hit your head with a baseball bat, it feels really good when you stop.
Right.
I really hope that Joe is right, and I think he is, that 2014 is going to be a better year than 2013, which isn't saying much. But what he's focusing on also, though, is that one of the effects of the, you know, hitting yourself on the head with a baseball bat or somebody else doing it is that, you know, at the Partnership for Public Service, we've been tracking employee job satisfaction and commitment for the last 10 years. We do our Best Places to Work and Government rankings based on the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey. And in the 10-year history that we've been tracking this, 2013 was a new low point,
mm-hmm.
Lower than it had been in the previous 9 years in terms of employees, reports in this anonymous confidential survey about whether they would recommend government as a place to work, whether, you know, their own commitment and satisfaction. And what's going to be really interesting about 2014 is to see, because this is a survey that's done by the Office of Personnel Management every year, they'll roll one out this later this spring, is to see whether or not employee morale, if you will, is a lagging indicator or a leading indicator. Things are getting better. You know, they've got the 1% pay increase.
Mm-hmm.
They've got stable budgets. So there's a lot of reasons to think that, you know, it's got to be, you know, better. But, you know, that's not an off-on switch in terms of how employees view the job. And I've been talking in the last few weeks to a lot of chief human capital officers, and one of their concerns on this employee engagement commitment front is that the lingering impact of the shutdown, which is now over, the lingering impact of the furloughs, which were, you know, they did not get paid for furlough days under sequestration. It was like there's a change in the psychological employment contract.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I come to work, I don't get rich, but I have a steady job and I have meaningful work. And it's like, well, you know, we changed that. So, well, you'll come to work when we're not fighting over budget, and you'll get paid when we decide, you know, we can do that. So 2014 is going to be a better year. We don't know if 2014 is going to be a better year in the view, in the mind of employees. Are we going to – and the thing about employee engagement is not are they happy or not. It's about, you know, are they coming to work and giving that discretionary energy that any employee can give, but you can't demand.
Yep. The concept of the best places to work, by the way, kudos to your colleague Lara Shane, who was on the program with me earlier in the week talking about best places to work along with Dan Helfrich from Deloitte.
She did a nice job.
She did a great job. But Mark, when we look at those numbers and we think about what they mean, there's another management element, which has kind of been a thread of what we've seen throughout all of the stories we've talked about today. And that is, all right, now what do I do with them? Now that I understand what the people that work for me think, how do I go about changing that to make sure that they want to still work for me? Or do I even care enough to want to do something about it? And that seems to me to be the key element. Am I off base there, do you think?
I'm just thinking about some of the hokey things that I see in these agencies, like we'll buy this IDEA software. I'm sure it's fine software. And everybody gets to vote on everybody else's great ideas, and that should make them feel better. or we'll have a parade. If everybody gets to run around in their Halloween costume, and that'll improve morale. You know, and I'm sure John knows this much better now. That's kind of hokey stuff to me. That's not what's a real thing that I think helps with morale. You know, clearly you're right about this. I believe it's a social contract. People go into government not just because they want a job, but generationally. I mean, we saw this in our generation. You want to know that you're doing something valuable. If you're not going to get paid as much as the guys that are totally focused on money, you want to know you're doing something valuable. And if you can't clearly identify your role in creating the value to the citizenry that you'd like to serve, it really makes it rough when things like sequestration are around.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by John Palgudas from the Washington Post. For federal employees, 2014 won't be as bad as 13, but morale problems linger. A great federal news countdown. It's terrific to see you both again. John Palgudas, the Partnership Public Service, and Mark Foreman of Government Transaction Services. And hour number two of In-Depth with Francis Rose right around the corner. All of our stories and our conversation archived later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.